Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for, oh, it's the first day of December. Happy December the 1st. It's Thursday. We have a couple of really good hours coming up. And before I tell you about the first hour, I want to tell you that the Nancy Pearl book list is on our Facebook page. Chrissy put that together, and it's there, and it's recommendations of fabulous books as you're shopping and want to consider gifts, or if you just want to read and get your reading list together for next year, go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and there you will find the list. And that is good. Our little present to you for this holiday season. This hour, we're going to be talking about the American Jobs Act. As you know, there's a great deal of talk about what will happen later this week. The majority leader, Harry Reid, is expected to force a vote on Friday, tomorrow, on the Democratic leadership's plan to extend the one-year payroll tax cut for employees that is set to expire at the end of this year. This is part of the American Jobs Act, and we're going to be talking about the act this hour of the program. It encompasses a great deal. It looks at rebuilding and modernizing America, according to their sheet that talks about what this is. Pathways back to work for Americans looking for jobs, and American Jobs Act overview is on this. Tax cut to help America's small business hire and grow. Pathways including, a number of things. Reemployment assistance. The president is reiterating his call to extend unemployment insurance, preventing 6 million people looking for work from losing their benefits, and extending what the Congressional Budget Office has determined is the highest bang for the buck option to increase economic activity. We're also going to be looking at the international picture as well. The stock market, as you know, went way up yesterday, and Europeans are happy with what the banks did. One of our guests this hour, joining us a little bit later, is a member of the Obama cabinet. Ambassador Ron Kirk will be joining us. He's the United States Trade Representative and serves as the president's principal trade advisor, negotiator, and spokesperson on trade issues. He will be joining us to talk about the international part of this whole jobs picture. Joining us the first part of the program is Professor Randall Ray, a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, as well as research director at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at Bard College in New York. He's a past president of the Association for Institutional Thought and served on the board of directors of the Association for Evolutionary Economics. He has been co-editor of the International Journal of Environment, Workplace, and Employment, and has focused on monetary theory and policy, macroeconomics, financial instability, and employment policy. He's the author of Understanding Modern Money, the Key to Full Employment and Price Stability. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many of them as this issue heats up, not that it hasn't been with us for some period of time. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Ray, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, yeah, great to have you here. Well, let's start with what is most topical, and that's that the Senate probably will be forcing a vote tomorrow on the one-year payroll tax cut for employees that will expire at the end of the year. Any chance that will pass, that some kind of compromise will be reached, and what happens if it doesn't pass?
I'm hopeful that the extension will pass. The American Jobs Act as a whole probably doesn't have much chance of getting through.
Why?
Well, we've already got several Democrats who have jumped the ship, and they've pledged to vote against it, and the Republicans have very little interest in seeing this go through, unfortunately.
They did say that they would be interested in extending a payroll tax cut, but they don't want to punish the job creators. Are the people who make a lot of money job creators in this country?
No. The people who are making a lot of money are mostly on Wall Street, broadly defined. It's the financial sector that sort of recovered and went back to what they'd been doing that led to the financial crisis. Those are definitely not job creators. They're job killers. There are pieces of the Jobs Act that will benefit the Main Street firms. And, you know, those I think are probably a good idea. But we know that supply-side policies, that is, tax cuts, tax incentives, tax credits for business, just don't work in a recession. And the reason is pretty obvious. Firms won't increase hiring until they see sales increase substantially. So tax cuts can't do that.
The other part of this, and I don't know when there is going to be a vote scheduled, but it seems to me as though it has to be fairly soon. There are millions of Americans who are going to lose their unemployment compensation by the end of this year as well. I don't know what they'll do without that money coming in, and we keep hearing about the number of people who are really about to be in dire straits. Will that be easier part of this American Jobs Act to get passed?
You know, boy, I just don't know. I'm an economist. I'm not that good at politics. It will be a disaster if the unemployment compensation is not extended. We've got so many people who are long-term unemployed who are not going to find a job until the economy recovers. And taking away their income is just going to hurt sales even more and lead to more unemployment. It'll be a disaster if they don't extend it.
Mm-hmm. The other parts of this plan don't seem as controversial as this key issue of whether or not we tax people who make more money. Is it as controversial? Are there good parts of this plan concerning teacher layoffs, concerning flex time for workers, that people will share jobs, work sharing, the Bridge to Work program, improving state programs where those displace those who are displaced take temporary voluntary work? There are parts of the program that will get people into the workforce in kind of alternative ways. Would that spark the economy?
I would separate the elements of the program into supply side and demand side. So there are various supply side proposals, including the tax cuts for business, but also enhancing movement back into work, making people more employable, sharing work in order to share the pain of lost jobs and lost hours. Those things don't create jobs, in my view. In a recession, that is not going to create any jobs. Therefore, it's not going to stimulate the economy. It's not going to get us back on a path to recovery, even if they are good ideas.
What about... Sorry. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to go to the second category, which is demand stimulus. And that is where the government actually is spending, either to create jobs or at least to prevent layoffs. Those, I think, do directly help the economy. And so, yeah, the preventing teachers from losing their jobs obviously makes sense both in the short run, because if they lose their jobs, our economy is going to get even worse. But in the long run, too, we can't afford to lose a generation of students just because the government won't spend the money that we need to educate them. You know, that is crazy. There's also elements of the proposal that will go toward renovating schools, which we absolutely need, both because it will help create jobs and also because we need to educate our students for the future. So those kinds of things will help the economy. Unfortunately, out of the $450 billion or so total spending, what I count up as demand-side policy is only about a quarter of that, about $100 billion. And in a $14 trillion economy, it's a little drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm. The president, of course, has talked about investment in infrastructure. Is this a big part of the bill? Obviously, there's a lot of work to be done in this area. Would this help unemployment significantly?
Well, the amount that is proposed is tiny. It's $50 billion. So certainly it helps. It should create some new jobs in the construction sector, which we desperately need job creation in that sector because of the collapse of the housing bubble. So it's good, but we could easily spend 10 times that. $500 billion would have been a much better target than $50 billion.
And the reason we can't go that high is because the focus has been on the deficit?
Yeah, and my own view is that tying the good parts of this bill, the spending increases, extending unemployment insurance, extending and increasing the payroll tax cut, all these are good measures. Tying those to increasing taxes, I think, is an economic and political mistake. Now, I'm all for raising taxes on the banksters that destroyed the economy, but tying good spending programs to raising taxes on the banksters and the wealthy who are making out like bandits just is going to automatically create 100% opposition in the Republican Party and turn away a significant number of Democrats so that there's no chance of getting the bill through. So I think it's a mistake.
How do we pay for it then?
Well, we pay for government spending the same way we always pay for it, and that is that the federal government credits bank accounts. The federal government can afford any spending. The question is whether the government is going to be spending so much that it fuels inflation by driving the economy beyond full capacity. Now, when we consider the level of unemployment, we've got 21 million people who either have lost their jobs or who have given up looking for work, so they're counted as out of the labor force. 21 million people right now today who would take jobs if they were offered. We've got firms all across the country that had to downsize who are operating way below capacity. In fact, overall capacity utilization is at the lowest point since the Great Depression. It is just crazy to believe that we can't have the government spend more, put people to work without causing any inflation.
And do you, I know you're not a politician, except that politics is involved in all of this. Do you hear anybody in Washington trying to accomplish or propose even what you just proposed?
Yes, there are a handful of people. Dennis Kucinich, for example, understands what I just said very clearly. He has his own Jobs Act, and he realizes that we don't need to raise taxes in a recession in order to have the government spend more. So there are a few sensible voices, but I do understand that the debt and deficit hysteria crowd absolutely dominates the discussion. It is a huge problem, and it makes me fairly pessimistic that we're going to get enough spending increase to get us out of this recession. We are slipping back in. It is looking more and more like we're going to have another global financial crisis. Could begin in Europe. I know that's not the topic for today, but could it also easily begin here. And we are in danger of slipping into another great recession.
And yet the news yesterday, I know it might be difficult and not a good idea to look at news day by day, but the stock market was just going really high yesterday, and Europe was very happy with the decision that was made to extend credit.
Right. It's, we really shouldn't be looking at day-to-day stock market movements as a gauge of the health of the economy. The stock market had gone down because of the problems with the euro, and now the Fed has said, well, we're going to help out the Europeans. We're going to lend some dollars. It's a stopgap measure. It's going to postpone the building financial crisis in Europe. It's not a solution at all to the problems in Europe, which are solvency problems, really not liquidity problems.
We have many people who want to weigh in on this issue, and we'll start taking phone calls in a moment. Our first guest is Professor Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and research director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at Bard College in New York. Later this hour, we will be speaking with Ambassador Ron Kirk, the U.S. trade representative, a member of the president's cabinet who serves as his principal trade advisor, negotiator, and spokesperson on trade issues. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, newly discovered evidence of two large pits on the east and west sides of Stonehenge suggests that the area may have been recognized as a sacred site at a much earlier date than previously thought. The archaeologist who has led this whole inquiry will be with us, Professor Vince Gaffney, Chair in Landscape Archaeology and Geomatics at the University of Birmingham. So that's our number two, Stonehenge. Let's start taking phone calls for Professor Randall Ray, and we begin with Pat in Waukesha. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. Well, I'm not a professor. I'm not an economist, but I just feel like your guest mentioned that we're seeing a global financial crisis in Europe. It's not because of not enough spending. It's because of too much spending. We recently saw an $800 billion stimulus package where we're supposed to have shovel-ready jobs. For some reason, there weren't many shovel-ready jobs. I talk to a lot of small business owners. I sell business insurance here in the state of Wisconsin, and I hear the same thing from them every day. And it's a story that's not being told. They cannot find good employees. The fact of the matter is, unemployment benefits, it's been proven over and over and over again. We're going on 2 years now of permanent unemployment benefits. And when those benefits end, that's when people take a job. There's literally people turning down good jobs because they don't want to work 10-hour days, 4 days a week. I hear these stories over and over, and I can't believe that we're talking about more spending. I think everybody feels in this country that our biggest problem right now is we've spent so much money, and I think we have to go the opposite direction. As far as tax cuts, I wholeheartedly agree with your caller. The bankers, the doctors, the lawyers, they can be afford to get taxed more. The problem is when we group them in with the Bush tax cuts, that hits a lot of these small business owners I just talked about. And the fact of the matter is, if we repeal those tax cuts on the rich, it's only $800 billion over 10 years, $80 billion a year for a deficit that's $1.5 trillion in the red. I just don't see that making much of a difference.
All right, Professor A.
Okay. Look, the anecdotes are useful, but they don't really provide a clear and correct picture of what's going on in the United States. We've got 84 million people who are not in the labor force. None of these are collecting unemployment compensation. The number that have lost their jobs, went on unemployment for a while, or did not qualify for unemployment compensation. By the way, less than 40% of the people who lose their jobs qualify for unemployment compensation anyway. The majority do not qualify. So they look for a while for a job. They cannot find one. They go out of the labor force. The number out of the labor force has grown from 79 million to 84 million during this crisis. The number of unemployed has grown from 7 million to 15 million. The vast majority of those are not collecting unemployment compensation. There are reasons why an employer will turn down prospective employees. The length of time unemployed is a very important consideration for employers. When you have someone come in who hasn't had a job in 2 years, 3 years, we've been in this crisis for over 3 years, they don't look like a good employee. Employers much prefer to hire someone who already has a job. The best job seekers are the ones already employed. And so part of the Jobs Act was to try to force employers to hire veterans who are unemployed. And, you know, maybe this will have some positive impact, but it's very difficult to get an employer to hire someone that they think is not a good prospective employee. The longer that we have very high unemployment, the higher the percentage of people without jobs who look like they're not good employees grows. This is called hysteresis. And we need to break this cycle of people losing their jobs, can't find a job, become unemployable in the views of the employers because they've been unemployed too long.
Thank you, Pat, for your call. Let's go to Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. Yesterday on the PBS NewsHour, Representative Baresco of Wyoming was on. He's a Republican from Wyoming. And he said people on unemployment or food stamps make a huge amount of money, huge amount of money. So I don't think the Republicans will be voting for any extension of unemployment.
They make a huge amount of money?
He emphasized huge. They make a huge amount of money. Representative Baresco on the PBS NewsHour yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, for the older listeners, we all remember President Reagan claiming that welfare mothers drive Cadillacs.
Right.
You know, it's nonsense. I'm sorry. People on unemployment or food stamps do not make a lot of money. In fact, to qualify for food stamps, you have to be low income. Food stamps is a huge program. It is growing. It's been growing on trend for a long time. But it is precisely because we have so many people who are trying to squeak by on very low incomes. They're not getting wealthy on food stamps. In any program, whether it's government or in the private sector, there is some abuse. There is some fraud. And we all should be opposed to fraud, obviously. But the percentage of people who are not poor, who somehow manage to get food stamps, is extremely low.
Joining us, we'll continue our conversation with Professor Ray in a moment. Joining us now is Ambassador Ron Kirk. He is the United States Trade Representative, a member of President Obama's cabinet, serving as the president's principal trade advisor, negotiator, and spokesperson on trade issues. He served two terms as the first African-American mayor of Dallas, and he was Texas Secretary of State under Governor Ann Richards. He has practiced law, and he is with us to talk about some of the international picture items here, because he is very much involved in all of that, the European crisis and the United States dealing with European countries. And so we're happy to have him as our guest. And we can take a couple phone calls for him as well. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our focus, though, remains the American Jobs Act. Ambassador Ron Kirk, thank you very much for being with us.
Kathleen, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Tell me if, and this is a huge if, the American Jobs Act, most of it were to pass Congress, what effect would it have on the economy of the rest of the world? Are people in Europe looking for us to take some action?
Well, they are. I think, Kathleen, that's a great place to start. And you've got to believe that not only Europe, but the rest of the world is as anxious about how our Congress will respond to the need to get our economy going, to keep our recovery growing and to spur job creation is we are now, I think, very cognizant of the fact that what happens in Europe impacts our economy. And I say that if you, for those of your listeners that watch the market, interestingly enough, our market seems to react more to the economic uncertainty around Europe than it has around the United States, and likewise. But your underlying premise is one that's correct. We are in a globally linked economy now in which the health of the United States consumer in particular has extraordinary implications for the health of these other economies around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason the president wants Congress to act is that our American families deserve it. They need help. America's families didn't create this economic mess. They didn't create the housing bubble, the finance bubble. They didn't participate in the relaxation of rules on finance that allowed some of the shenanigans that created this mess. But our families do need help. And it only makes sense to deploy those tools that Congress has at its disposal, that we've used in the past with strong bipartisan support, like the payroll tax cut for families, like tax cuts for small businesses, since we know they tend to deploy that money right away, like investing in our infrastructure that's crumbling in many of our cities and states around it. Let's do things that make sense because they're going to be good for the American consumer and the American working family.
We are, as you well know, have already begun a campaign season. Is it just a pipe dream to think that we're going to get any kind of bipartisan support at this time, a year before an election, on these vital issues?
Well, we have to believe that it's not. And we would say, you know, we are getting some elements of it. As you know, the president was fairly insistent that he believed Congress should pass every element of it. But we have begun to address some of the transportation element. You know, they passed provisions related to employing and helping our returning veterans.
Yes.
Veterans. But we're now dealing with the reality, unless Congress acts, and they act before the end of the year, that the payroll tax cut that the president was able to get passed last year, again, with support from Democrats and Republicans, that's going to expire. And that would mean your average family, you know, in Wisconsin, and I hate using that, I know there'll be people that are under it over, but the family of Wisconsin that makes $50,000 a year, instead of maintaining that $1,500 a year tax cut, they could be hit with a $1,000 tax increase. And that just makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. Give me an international picture here. I know that you are leading a panel along with the European Union Trade Commissioner to boost U.S. European trade and investment. Tell me about this big picture part of our unemployment. What are you doing to create more jobs for the millions of Americans who are unemployed?
Well, one of the simple things we're doing is the president challenged us to not only look at tools we can deploy to kind of get America out of our economic malaise, but make America competitive long term. And, you know, one of the president's greatest strengths is he really does, you know, people forget how much he was ridiculed for being a quote unquote community organizer when he ran.
Right.
But if you remember the work he did as a community organizer, you know, this is someone who got his start in politics helping families who had been displaced. And so that's what he wakes up and thinks about every day. And one of the simple realities that we have to embrace is part of our economic future is going to be our ability to sell more of what we make, what we grow, what we raise, what we innovate in America to consumers around the world. We have the most mature, dynamic consumer market in the world, and that's benefited us marvelously for the last 50 years. But we're now looking at a world with 7 billion people in which 95% of the world's consumers live somewhere other than the United States. One way we can create jobs here, we need to save more, and we need to sell more to these new consumers in places like China and India and Latin America and Africa. And that's what's driving our export policy. And so we're using all the tools we have, whether it's through our trade with the European Union or with China, Africa, Asia, to frankly do one simple thing. How do we find more customers for our products that are made in America that will help create sustain jobs here in the U.S.
What is it that we keep hearing, Ambassador, about China and Brazil and India having these vital, strong economies? You're a guy who's been traveling the world and dealing with these issues for some time now. What are they doing that that makes them so successful?
Well, some of it's, you know, and I don't want to belittle that because, when you look at our economic growth, and our economy is growing, but it's not at a level enough to get the unemployment down. But we've now had 20 consecutive months of job growth, you know, despite what some people may do in political rhetoric. But if you look at the numbers, we've added over 2 million jobs the last, 10, 15 months. But we need to be growing above 3% to really impact that unemployment rate. Part of what's happening with these, as we call them, emerging economies in Africa, Brazil, India, China, is that they have had so many people living in extreme poverty for so long that you just have this huge, massive migration from people away from farms and in the cities, and they're beginning to create a little bit of wealth. And so their curve of moving people away from an agrarian society to an industrial, society has been slower than ours. And some of it's that they're just beginning to move those people into not what we would define as middle class, but a consumptive class. And so they're attractive markets. They can now afford a different level of protein, in their diet. They are beginning to afford some consumer products that we make, and they're moving away from riding bicycles to motorcycles to driving cars. I don't want to oversimplify it, but there's hundreds of millions of them.
Right.
I mean, China, India, Africa have the opportunity to add two populations that are the size of the United States. Our growth has slowed. We're never going to have 1 billion people. We may never have 500 million. Well, they've already got, 3.5-4 billion people among them. And, one of the simplest rules of business is just location, location, location. You go where the new customers are.
Right.
So it makes sense for us to be in these markets. And secondly, even though it's counterintuitive to many Americans, because our consumer market is so based, because we built an economy in which we frankly built a middle class, and that we wanted everyone to have the ability to have a home and send their kids to school. We had more people who could buy stuff. And the power of that is what helped rebuild Europe after World War II. It's helped rebuild economies throughout Asia. And President Obama wisely now says, look, now that some of these economies are on their feet, it's our turn. Let us have access to your consumers as we freely gave you access to ours over the last 30, 40 years. We've helped rebuild economies all over the world. That's a good thing. But now it's only fair that they lower barriers to entry, lower tariffs, and give us access to their markets. If we do that, that is a great way to complement other strategies to grow our economy and create jobs.
As you well know, we can't in this country seem to get off who we're going to tax and how much they should be taxed and whether or not the wealthy should pay more. As you look at this whole issue, can the American Jobs Act become a reality if we don't tax people in this country who make more money? Is it just off the table if we don't change our tax policy?
Well, we have to do all of those things, and that's why the president, frankly, Kathleen, submitted the Jobs Act separate. Congress has the response. Congress has one responsibility, to appropriate and budget the money and control it. That's why we have a federalist system in which the president runs the government, but Congress has the appropriation authority. That's their job, and they need to do that job. But as they're doing it, one of the reasons the president is so bullish on this Jobs Act, many of those strategies are going to take time. Everyone agrees we need to reform our tax code. What we need is more revenue. You can't have prosecuted two wars, put in a Medicare program that the previous administration didn't pay for, provide all these tax cuts which they didn't pay for, and do it in which you're not getting a new revenue source. Now, one way some people believe is that you simply raise taxes. Others believe if you reform the tax code, you can get more people paying, make it fair. But as you and I know, Kathleen, that will take Congress months, if not a year, to accomplish. What we're asking for in this Jobs Act are strategies that presidents, Democrat and Republicans, have used time and time again because they work, because they put money into pockets of middle-class families and small businesses who don't tend to go rush to put that money into market. They go out and pay off bills. They pay their kids' education. They invest in their homes and their businesses. They put money back into the economy because the long-term objective is we want to get the economy growing again. A healthy economy is the best way to bring down our deficit, to create wealth, and put America back to work.
Right.
But while the banks aren't lending, the big businesses are sitting on the sidelines, let's empower America's family and small business.
So how do we go about doing that? I mean, what strategy is available if we have to forget the idea of increasing taxes because it's so divisive and it's just not going anywhere? How can major parts of the American Jobs Act pass without that element? Can they?
Well, again, I want to make it plain, Kathleen. The president did not put a tax increase as part of the Jobs Act. The Jobs Act was specifically structured,
right.
And the president, you know, he was always asked, why can't we have bipartisan stuff? He picked ideas, the Democrats and Republicans in champion. For example, the part of the Jobs Act to rebuild our infrastructure came from a bill sponsored by Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, a Republican from Texas, and Senator Kerry. Because we've heard from governors, mayors all around the country, we've got a great highway system and bridge system, but most of this was built as part of the WTA. These roads and bridges are obsolete. We can't compete in today's connected world with an outmoded technology. We need to do this anyway. It's a great way to rebuild our infrastructure and at the same time put hundreds of thousands of construction workers, school teachers, police officers, firemen back to work. Let's do that now. And again, I address the issues of the payroll tax for families and businesses. And while we do that, we shouldn't punish those families that need help that are on unemployment. We've got to extend the unemployment tax. That the president put together a fairly modest but thoughtful package that doesn't require Congress to raise taxes. They can pay for it. Through other revenue savings and other revenue measures. But we should do that.
And a final question. I know you have a busy day here, but our guest before, our economist who's been with us before we chatted with you, thinks that this is really just a drop in the bucket. It may be a good program that will help some, but what we need is a whole lot more.
Well, I mean, absolutely we do. But, I mean, all of us know that old story about, you know, the little boy who's walking along the beach after a storm and he's picking up starfish and throwing them back in the ocean. And one, you know, brilliant economist comes along and says, young man, you know, I know that's noble, but it's only one of you, and there's hundreds of, you know, if not thousands of starfish. You can't save them all, and you can't make a difference to all of them. But the kid looks at him and says, I can make a difference to this one. You know, what I would say to him is, that's no reason. That is not an argument to not do things that will help families all across this country. The payroll tax cut extension will probably help 90% of American families. Investing in small businesses, you know, well, in the case of Wisconsin, you've got 110,000 small businesses that would benefit from that tax cut. And they could either put that money into the pockets of their workers, they could go hire somebody else. If we pass the infrastructure part of it, you've got over $1 billion worth of infrastructure projects in Wisconsin that could be deployed and put 19,000 people to work. This is a shot in the arm. The president's never argued it was the silver bullet, but while we work on deficit reduction and budget control and tax reform, let's do something now. The Democrats and Republicans can agree on that'll help American families. They can't wait.
Yeah.
They don't have 2 years. Many of our families don't have another 6 months.
They're hurting. Yeah, I hear
they
you.
Need help now.
Yeah. Ambassador Kirk, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. And I know you all got a big football game coming up this weekend, I think, in Wisconsin. So good luck to you.
We always have a big football game coming up.
You know, I was privileged to be in Madison once and see that whole Saturday red storm thing. It's pretty impressive.
It is indeed. Thanks very much. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, ma'am.
Our guest for part of the show, Ambassador Ron Kirk, U.S. Trade Representative. He is a member of the President's Cabinet and is the principal trade advisor, negotiator, and spokesperson spokesperson on trade issues. We'll continue our conversation with Professor Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and take more of your phone calls and emails in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, we're going to be speaking with the lead archaeologist who has made this remarkable discovery. They've been working at Stonehenge since 2010, employing geophysical imaging techniques to develop a profile of the site's ritual uses, and they have made a remarkable discovery of two large pits on the east and west sides of Stonehenge. We'll talk about why those are so significant, our number two, with this lead investigator who's chair in landscape archaeology and geomatics at the University of Birmingham. Professor Randall Ray remains with us, and we go to more of your phone calls. Greg in Watertown is our next caller. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Kathleen. I appreciate the program and the in-depth analysis that you folks allow these issues to have. But, I heard the previous guest comment that we needed to create wealth and that we needed to grow the economy. And I think what we're doing is wrong. It won't work because it's such a reductionist viewpoint of how to increase the economy. I think we need to think more holistically, and we need to recognize the consequences of an ever-present growth state. And we need to recognize that we live on a finite planet, and we're going to be running into a bunch of constraints, the peak phenomenon constraints. It's going to happen with all of our resources eventually. And to expect that we can grow our way out of this, it just isn't going to work. And I think if we are going to try, or if we are going to turn the economy around and turn our society around, we need to design more by principle. And I'd propose three principles, one of them that we need to reduce. Instead of grow, we need to start to think about how we can reduce, because we're going to run out of resources and supplies, and we can develop those resources, but it's very difficult to grow them. And that's my second principle. We need to increase the capital upon which the system is built, the principle upon which our economy grows. We need to, when we decide to do this or to do that, we need to understand, is it increasing our social capital? Is it paying high pay, good wages? Is it a living wage? Is it creating community? And ecologically, is it extracting from our ecological principle and resource base, or is it increasing it? And in many cases, we can do things that actually increase our ecological capital, and I think in all cases we can do it to increase our social capital.
All right, let me hold you there. We have a ton of people who want to talk. Professor Ray.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But the things he's talking about, increasing social capital, increasing ecological capital, is creating jobs. It is leading to economic growth. I absolutely agree that what we need is green growth, green jobs, ecologically sustainable growth. But that will create jobs, too. And we're already massively a service sector economy. We have to get out of our minds the notion that growth comes from creating more industry. The future is in the service sector. It's in the knowledge sector. And this doesn't necessarily have to hurt the environment.
Well, it wasn't all that long ago that we were hearing from a number of people, the president included, that we were going to see a huge growth in green jobs, and stimulus money was to go for clean energy, et cetera. What's happened to all of that, to that sector of the economy? Is it indeed growing?
I believe that it is growing as well as it can, given the state of the overall economy. So really, we face two problems. One, this kind of growth, green, sustainable growth, needs leadership from Washington. And right now, that is very difficult to do. The second thing is it will be much more successful if the economy as a whole is doing better. Why would you invest right now, make a major investment in something that is relatively risky when the risks are already tremendously high that we're going to slip back into recession? So we need more guidance from Washington, and we need to get the economy back on track.
We go next to Lou in Chicago. Hi, Lou.
Yes. Hello, Professor Ray. I have two questions, if you will permit me. The first one being, what happened yesterday with the Fed and the European central banks supposedly causing a 500-point spike in the Dow? And who's going to pay for that?
Okay. Well, since the global financial crisis began in 2008, the Fed has been lending dollar reserves to financial institutions here in the U.S. and abroad. The Fed, this will shock you, but the Fed, if you cumulatively, the Fed has lent $29 trillion. Now, most of those loans get repaid very quickly. The Fed already had a program just like the one that it announced yesterday of lending to the European Central Bank. The reason is because a lot of firms in Europe have dollar liabilities, and because their sales are down due to the recession, they are having trouble meeting their liabilities. So the Fed is lending dollars to Europe, and then the European Central Bank can lend on to the national central banks, which then lend on to the domestic banks. In a sense, nobody pays for this. As long as these loans are good loans, the ECB and the European central banks will repay them, and the loans are just retired. Now, the worst-case scenario is if the Fed makes a lot of loans that go bad, both domestically and abroad, and then the normal profits that the Fed pays to the Treasury will be reduced. That will increase the size of our budget deficit. And if the Fed's losses became big enough, it will become insolvent in the same way that private banks become insolvent, and the Treasury would have to bail it out, just like the Treasury using the FDIC bails out insolvent private banks. But I'm not suggesting that that is a likely scenario. I'm just giving you the worst-case scenario.
Thanks, Lou, for the call. Email from Tom in Wausau. I refuse to identify with either major political party. They're both at fault for our current situation. I agree with your guest. Kindergarten Economics says there can't be a job without someone buying the good or service for which people are hired to provide. My observation is that the Republicans are better at spreading panaceas, that is, a lie, reducing taxes to job creators produces jobs. It's been told so many times without rebuttal that most people believe it.
I absolutely agree. Here is the fundamental, most basic proposition that we can get out of economics. Firms hire the number of workers they think they need to produce the amount of output they think they can sell. If they don't believe they can sell output, it doesn't matter how low the wage goes or how many tax credits you give them, they will not employ workers to produce goods that they can't sell. That's economics basic 101.
Thanks, Lou, for the call. We go next to, I think I lost our caller there. Please call back. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that. 800-486-8655. And another email from Brian in Monona. I think the Democrats should call the Republicans bluff. Let's go ahead and agree that anyone making more than $1 million a year who can prove that they created a full-time job can be exempted from any tax increase. All others are not job creators. They ought to do the patriotic thing and help out in this crisis.
I'm sympathetic, but again, you know, relying on philanthropy of rich people and big business to create jobs where they don't see it in their interest to do that is not going to be very successful. So I think that Washington needs to play a bigger role. Let's get the economy pumping again, and then the private sector will start creating jobs. I really liked what the ambassador said about the WPA.
Yes.
Look, we know how to do this. We did it in the 1930s. We created 12 million jobs with a much smaller population than we have today in order to get the economy going. We built infrastructure all over this country. It was the WPA that brought America into the 20th century. We were a 19th century country and economy until the WPA created the infrastructure, built all the schools, built the public buildings, built dams, roads, and other infrastructure, created the economy that allowed us to greatly raise living standards, become a middle-class society, with good growth and opportunities for most Americans for 50 years. But we did nothing on that scale after the war. And now all of that infrastructure that was built is going on, 80 years old. Mm. We need to rebuild.
Our guest this part of the show, Professor Randall Ray, we thank him for joining us, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and we also thank Ambassador Ron Kirk, United States Trade Representative, for being with us to talk about the economy. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of you, but we were busy. Stay with us. Great hour ahead.